moving. He had run all the way from the center of Turkey River after the SOS came in over the comms about a variant attack, covering nearly 3 miles in the past 32 minutes. It wasn't a record pace by any means, but with his gear and the threat of mines, he couldn't run much faster, especially without letting his guard down. Leaving Cedric didn't help matters, and Fitz wasn't sure he would be where they left him when they returned. But there was no way in hell he would bring the guy back out here. Lincoln kept up with Fitz, but Ace fell behind, stopping every few minutes to breathe. "Go on," he called out, hands on his knees. He raised one of them, waving to proceed without him. "I'll catch up." Fitz and Lincoln didn't waste time. They kept moving into the dense forest, following the sound of gunfire and the ethereal screeches of dying monsters. A half a mile later, they came up on a hill that blocked their view of the forest. Fitz balled his hand and slowly moved up the slope, leaves crunching under his blades. Ace finally caught up behind them, panting like a wild boar. "Holy shit," Fitz said, staring at the scene of carnage. Rico and Mendez stood in the middle of it, surrounded by a red halo of dead beasts. "Come on," Fitz said. He hurried down the hill and set off across an area of holes seeping the variant's noxious, rotten odor, but stronger, like it had been distilled and hyper-concentrated. "You okay?" Fitz whispered. Rico and Mendez both nodded but kept their rifles up, still roving the barrels for contacts. Lincoln and Ace joined them, weapons also up. "Where's Dohai?" Fitz asked, keeping his voice low. Rico simply pointed at the ground. Fitz crept to the edge of a gaping hole and peered over the edge. The full brunt of the carrion smell made his eyes water. Moonlight illuminated a patch of the tunnel covered in webs of strange tissue stretching across the soil. He bent down for a better look. A variant, the color of an earthworm, came bursting from the tunnel, knocking Fitz backward. Vessels bulged under its skin, ropey muscles tensing. Fitz brought up his rifle and shot it in the head. The beast fell limply to the floor of the tunnel, landing with a thud. The other team members huddled around, all of them looking down. Fitz tried Dohai on the comms. Nothing came back but static. He pushed his NVGs away from his eyes and flicked on the tactical light mounted to the bottom of his gun barrel. The others did the same, angling the light into the tunnel. The drop to the bottom appeared to be about 10 feet.
"We're going in there, aren't we?" Lincoln said.
Fitz nodded.
"Shit."
Fitz and Rico helped lower Ace down first. Then Rico dropped in with Mendez and Fitz following. Lincoln came last, his boots smacking against the mud-filled tunnel floor. Maybe it was an illusion, but the red vines and webbing looked like they were actually pulsating. Fitz moved quietly, taking it all in. The tunnel appeared to have a diameter of about 10 feet and seemed to travel north, winding so he couldn't see the end. The southern end was blocked by piles of fallen soil and rock. While the walls and ceiling were curved, the floor seemed to be pounded nearly flat. What in the hell kind of twisted variant engineering was this? He had seen tunnels, especially in Europe. The worm variants had burrowed under the cities, but as far as he knew, they'd never made it across the Atlantic. And from his experience, they didn't leave behind this webbing. No, this was something entirely different. The only tunnels he had seen in the States were man-made. This was something beyond anything he experienced. A wail broke the silence, and a variant came bounding into the tunnel. 5 tactical lights hit the beast as it moved, digging claws into the red tendrils stretching over the walls and ceiling like a spider web. It practically galloped toward them on the ceiling, using the tendrils to move.
"Ace, take it down," Fitz ordered. "I got this ugly son of a—" Ace said, his voice silenced by the boom of his shotgun.
Bits of the red tendrils flew away with the shot as the variant leapt away unharmed. He pumped the weapon and fired again. This time the buckshot found a home in its skull, erasing all former human features in a fine pink mist. The corpse slammed against the muddy floor, kicking up wet muck. An angry roar echoed through the tunnel from seemingly all directions. The team turned to search for the source. Ace bumped into Mendez.
"Watch it, big guy," Mendez said.
"Get out of my way, dude," Ace shot back.
"Take it easy," Fitz said. "Watch your zones."
That smell of rotten fruit seemed to waft off the red webs covering the walls as their beams flitted through the black. He had no idea what it was, but it sure as hell looked like something Kate would be interested in seeing in the lab. Right now, though, lab samples could wait. Dohai could not. The roars faded away, leaving them in silence. Fitz waited another moment before giving the advance sign. They followed the winding tunnel, darkness swallowing them except for the patches illuminated with their beams. Every surface was covered with the same gruesome webbing. The hairs on the back of Fitz's neck stood straight, almost as if they were passing through an electric current. Variant shrieks echoed, but sounded distant, like they were moving away from the team. The monotony of the massive tunnel was interrupted for the first time with an intersection. The team halted, the faint echo of their movement fading away into silence. Fitz heard something dripping to the right. "Which way?" Rico whispered. A human scream to the right provided their answer. Ace took point, and the team moved in behind the large man and his shotgun. The tunnel they entered next looked like it had been dug by a group of human-sized moles. It was wide enough for them to walk through three abreast, and tall enough no one had to duck down. The red vines were even more dense, covering every surface, even the ground. Now Fitz was almost certain some of those webs were pulsing. He caught Rico and Mendez studying the webbing, but Ace's shotgun never strayed from pointing straight ahead. The tunnel curved back and forth slightly, bending just enough to prevent them from seeing what lay beyond each turn. The squawks and growls carried through the narrow passage, but the echo made it difficult to determine distance. Whatever this strange place was, there was no doubt that they had uncovered how the variants entered this outpost. The sensor systems wouldn't have caught anything invading the place from underground. Ace curled around another corner, then swiftly turned back, signaling contacts. "Dohai," Fitz mouthed. Ace shook his head. "Watch your fire zones for hostages," Fitz whispered. They inched around the corner, picked out targets, and all of them but Ace opened fire. The suppressed barks of their rifles echoed as they cut down several beasts that had been taken off guard. Those that survived the initial onslaught didn't turn around to attack like Fitz had expected. Instead, they bolted into the darkness. Fitz flashed an advance signal. The beasts ran up the sides of the tunnel and scurried across the ceiling, their claws and talons digging into the dirt around the webbing. Variants faded in and out of their beams, disappearing around the corner. The team slowed as they approached. Ace went first, moving into a straighter tunnel. "Clear," he said. Fitz went next, spotting dirt falling from the ceiling like sand trickling in an hourglass. He directed his flashlight beam on the feet of a variant just as it disappeared up a vertical tunnel. For a fraction of a second, he debated climbing up the webbing to pursue the beast. If the webbing could hold a variant, it could sure as hell hold him. But that would also expose him and the team to even more untold danger. Variants had the advantage when it came to climbing, and trying to fight a variant that had the upper ground in a place like this was even more of a nightmare than this mission had already turned into. Another human yell echoed down from the chimney-like tunnel. It didn't sound like Dohai, but if it was a civilian being taken away, then there was a damn good chance that's where the variants had Dohai too. "Ace, get—" A loud rumble interrupted Fitz. The tunnel seemed to shake. Fitz's blades nearly slipped from under him. Then the ceiling of the tunnel behind them began to collapse, dumping rock, webbing, and dirt. "We have to go up," Fitz yelled over the din. The other end of the tunnel was collapsing too. They would be buried alive down here if they didn't move. This must have been what happened to the half-buried humans Rico had described finding on the comms. The tunnels the variants had transported them through had broken down around those people, and Fitz didn't want to be next. Dirt showered him as he moved. Some of the webbing came loose, slapping over his face. He had to pry the sticky red strands off. God only knew what was waiting for them up top, but Fitz decided facing a few swinging variant claws was better than choking on dirt for the last few minutes of his life. Ace slung his shotgun and started climbing. Mendez followed with Fitz and Lincoln covering them. The collapsing ceilings were closing in from both sides. To Fitz, it was like being trapped in the throat of a giant creature trying to swallow them whole. He followed Lincoln up into the vertical shaft using the webbing. Lincoln moved fast, quickly ascending, but Fitz strained to propel himself up. His blades weren't so good for finding footholds. He managed to get purchase by jamming them in the side of the wall. Then he levered himself upward and stabbed them in again. The walls thumped below him, dust booming up into the shaft. Fitz coughed, but kept moving. A hand reached down and he looked up to see Lincoln. He reached for the man's fingers, but they were still short by more than a foot. The ground beneath Fitz rose, threatening to swallow his feet, the rumbling earth shaking his bones. Dirt started to break free from the vertical tunnel. Rocks and dirt clods smacked into his face and body. He tried to take that last step up, pushing to close the gap between his fingers and Lincoln's. His blade wouldn't budge. He'd embedded it too far into the dirt wall and now had to bounce on it, trying to break it free. The dirt around the blade moved, but he couldn't get it out. Fitz grunted and shoved down on his blade with all his strength, digging a small cavity in the wall. He yanked it free, then lunged upward. His fingers met Lincoln's, and the man pulled him up, the earth rising around him as the tunnel collapsed inward. On all fours above ground, Fitz gasped for air. He wiped the dirt covering his face, seeing they were in the woods. "Anyone got eyes?" Fitz managed between pants. "Negative," Ace said. Fitz listened for a second with the others, desperate to hear the cries of the variants or the screams from the hapless humans they had kidnapped. "Dohai," Fitz tried one last time over his comm channel. "Dohai, do you read?" Static came back again. Fitz looked back down at the collapsed tunnel and considered the reality of their situation. They had lost their best tracker and a good friend. They had no evidence he was alive. No tracks, no discarded equipment or a transmission. He picked up dirt and let it filter through his gloved fingers, his heart filling with dread. Parts of the red webbing stuck out of the ground where the tunnel had collapsed. He pulled out his knife and sawed off a handful of them, then stuffed them in his pack. They weren't taking Dohai back with them, but they weren't going home empty-handed. This shit was weird enough to warrant sending it back to a lab for analysis. "Bag some of this shit up," Fitz said. "We'll need a chopper to come back for Cedric anyway, and we can send some of this back with him. I have a feeling Kate is going to want to take a look at this immediately." Maybe there was some clue as to what this was and how the variants had used it and the tunnel to take out Outpost Turkey River. And maybe, just maybe, it would help them find Dohai at some point, even if it was just his body to bury.
"We going back with these samples?" Lincoln asked.
Fitz wanted to say yes, but emotions had to take a back seat to duty.
"We aren't going back until we find Dohai and figure out what the hell is going on," he said.
The team huddled around the hole, none of them saying what they were all likely thinking. For now, Dohai was on his own.
"All it takes is all you got, brother," Fitz thought.
The Portland Sheriff Department dual cab truck cut through the night without headlights, but soon the passengers wouldn't need their night vision goggles. Beckham glanced at the dashboard and confirmed it was almost morning. They had been pursuing the raiders for the past hour, and he was getting anxious the farther they drove from Portland. The driver of the truck ahead of them reported he could see one of the raiders, but Beckham still hadn't laid eyes on the person. Ruckley stared in the front passenger seat, her gaze seemingly glued to the dark road.
"We're outside the safe zone now," said the driver. "This is variant country."
Beckham saw the posted warning signs by the road, and Horn readied his M249 in the back seat next to him.
"Can't this truck go any faster?" Horn grumbled.
Beckham strained for a better view as the road curved ahead. Frankly, they were lucky they had caught up to this raider crew at all. The assholes had gotten a head start, but several citizens from Portland had followed them and relayed the information to the Rangers. A voice sounded from Ruckley's radio, and she pressed the receiver to her ear.
"Wilco,"
Ruckley said. Then she spoke over the channel to the rest of the team.
"Bravo, we're turning around. Now."
The brake lights of the pickup truck in front of them fired, glaring red as it stopped.
"What the hell are you doing?" Beckham said.
"Lieutenant Niven has called off the chase," Ruckley said. "He doesn't want to risk going into a variant hot zone."
"Fuck this," Horn said. "Keep going. This is bullshit."
Horn was still a pressurized boiler about to explode, and Beckham didn't have to know Ruckley as well to see she was just as angry about their orders. Enough anger and frustration radiated off them all to keep the truck cab hot, even without the use of its heater. Beckham was also steaming. They had let the raiders that killed Jake and slaughtered countless citizens get away.
Keep cool, Reed.
Beckham still wasn't sure what the death count was, but he guessed it was going to get worse when the sun rose and they sent out patrols to locate missing residents in Portland and Peaks Island.
The piece of shit raider we captured on Peaks Island is mine, Beckham said.
Ruckley glanced into the back seat again. I've got orders to bring him back to command, Captain. Can't stop you from interrogating him first, of course.
I just need a few minutes.
Horn nodded.
That's all it's going to take.
The two-truck convoy raced down the highway with their headlights on now. Beckham tried to focus on how lucky their families were to be okay after the bloodshed, but he couldn't help feeling that their luck was running out. They rode in silence for the first half of the trip back, but Ruckley broke it by turning around from the front seat again. These raiders could have been collaborators, she said. Maybe they had something to do with what happened to Turkey River.
In Iowa? Horn replied. That's a hell of a long way for variants and collaborators to coordinate attacks.
Captain, you got any ideas what's going on? She asked.
I was thinking the same thing as Horn, actually, Beckham said. But usually collaborators don't use bombs and hunt down civilians just to kill them. They kidnap people and take them to lairs to feed their variant masters.
Maybe they just knew we wouldn't follow them there, said the driver. I guess they were fucking right, Horn snorted.
Ruckley turned back to the front seat and lowered her helmet to listen to another message over a private channel.
Copy that, she replied, clearly frustrated.
Beckham expected her to fill them in, but she didn't say anything. He didn't push the issue. Niven's reason for turning them around was by the book, and Beckham and Horn couldn't do shit about it. They sat in silence for the rest of the ride. 20 minutes later, they turned onto an off-ramp on the outskirts of Portland. Razor wire fences marked the barrier into the inhabited part of the city. None of the defenses had stopped the raiders. Smoke billowed from fires in the heart of the safe zone. For so long, he told Javier and Kate they were safe here. Now he had to tell his son he'd been wrong and explain what had happened.
Come on, Reed. You're lucky you get to explain it to him at all.
There were others that wouldn't get the same opportunity. Timothy was now an orphan, and Jake would never get the chance to talk to his son again. The thought sent another surge of anger roaring through Beckham, just as their pickup pulled up in the town's square. Dozens of troops and emergency response personnel were on the ground, recent arrivals to help secure the area and help with the cleanup. White sheets covered the dead in front of Portland City Hall. The first bomb had gone off right outside the glass windows. The front wall was nothing but rubble, glistening with shards of broken glass and pieces of the metal plating where the roof had caved in. A second bomb had gone off inside the medical clinic after the raiders had taken what they wanted there. As if stealing medicine weren't bad enough, they had destroyed the city's emergency facilities, leaving the residents of Portland without a working medical center when it was needed most.
Sick sons of bitches, Beckham thought.
The military had already put up a makeshift tent, and Beckham saw several doctors and nurses working on patients through the open flap. Kate was inside, but that was no surprise. Beckham and Horn followed Ruckley and the other rangers toward the police station without stopping. Multiple generators-powered lights set up around the staging area, casting a carpet of light over the devastation. Beckham stepped over broken glass and charred metal, and his blade splashed into a puddle of blood. He looked down to see a severed hand missing several fingers. The remaining finger still wore a wedding ring. The rest of the body was under a sheet a few feet away, judging by the stump of a wrist sticking out. A group of civilians carried off the dead and loaded them into the back of a pickup truck. One of the men dropped a corpse and bent over, vomiting on the street. Beckham felt sick to his stomach, too. All of this senseless death, and for what? The raiders could have taken what they wanted. Why slaughter so many innocent people? There had to be more to this story, and in a few minutes he was going to talk to the one person that knew the answers. Lieutenant Niven stood outside the police station talking on a handheld radio. He looked at Beckham as he approached.
Yes, Captain Beckham is here, Niven said into the radio. Yes, I'll let him know.
Beckham halted, anticipating more bad news.
Captain, Master Sergeant, Niven said in turn. That was command. Got an update from Team Ghost at Turkey River. They found some of the missing townsfolk. Apparently the variants dug tunnels and used them to get inside the perimeter without being detected.
And that's how they got the people out, too, without leaving a trace above ground, Beckham said. More of a statement than a question.
Sounds that way, Niven said. He paused a moment, looking tense. The pit at the bottom of Beckham's stomach started to give way.
There's something else, isn't there?
Sergeant Yaz Dohai is MIA.
Son of a bitch, Beckham whispered. Things kept getting worse.
What about the rest of Team Ghost?
They're back at the outpost waiting for reinforcements, Niven replied.
Sounds like Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick sent a sample of webbing from the tunnels that he wants the White Coats to look at.
Boss, Horn said, jerking his chin.
He was anxious to see the raider, and so was Beckham.
We'd like to have a chat with the prisoner, Beckham said.
Be my guest, but don't rough him up too much, Niven said. I need him in one piece for command.
Horn mumbled something under his breath and followed it up with a snort.
Sergeant Ruckley, escort them, please.
Yes, sir, she said.
Beckham followed her into the lobby. A lantern lit the desks and closed office doors beyond the reception area. They proceeded to the hallway and down a stairwell which led to the cells in the basement. A single ranger stood guard outside the main door.
Sergeant, he said.
Open it up, she replied.
The man unlocked the door and stepped inside. Ruckley went first and stopped two strides in.
What in the actual fuck, she said.
Beckham moved past her, stopping at the sight of the raider curled up on the floor. Flesh had melted away from his face. The rancid smell forced Beckham to hold a sleeve to his nose.
Guard!
Ruckley shouted. The ranger that had been holding sentry duty rushed in.
What the hell happened? Ruckley asked.
The man shook his head.
I don't know. He was fine when I checked 30 minutes ago.
Beckham and Horn moved over to the old-school barred door. The lock sizzled, and strands of a clear, hardened material hung from it like strands of solid glue.
The hell? Horn said.
Don't, Beckham said to the guard who held up a key. The ranger backed away.
Variant acid.
Beckham was intimately familiar with the gunk that had taken his leg and part of his arm. It only took a small amount to do extreme damage. Horn pulled his skull bandana up over his nose.
Dude must have had some hidden away, and it backfired.
Niven joined them in the basement a few moments later. He paced and put a hand on the back of his head. Then he looked to the guard and yelled,
"How the hell did this happen, Rollins?"
"I'm sorry, sir," Rollins said.
"I thought I searched the guy really well."
"Fuck, fuck, fuck," Niven said. He stopped pacing, straightened, and drew in a breath.
"What a goddamn mess."
Beckham didn't know what to say. All he knew was the only man that could have answered their questions was dead. Sick to his stomach, he left the rangers in the basement and hurried up to the medical tent with Horn. Over 20 people, some of them gravely wounded, occupied the cots. Kate was busy working with two doctors on a guy in the middle of the room. The man was laying still on a table, and judging from the sheer amount of blood on the ground, he was in pretty bad shape. Beckham took a seat on the curb to wait.
"I want to talk to Kate before we go find the kids," he said.
Horn pulled out a cigarette.
"I figured as much."
Frantic voices came from inside the tent, and from the words Beckham picked up, it sounded like some unlucky patient was going into cardiac arrest. Horn took a drag on his cigarette and offered it to Beckham, but Beckham waved it away. The distant glow of a new sunrise warmed the horizon. Despite the view of a new day, his heart continued to pound from anxiety. There were too many questions in his mind.
"Hell of a few days," Horn mumbled. "Things could have been worse, though."
"It could still get worse, Big Horn. I got a bad feeling about all of this."
The voices in the tent trailed off, replaced by the sporadic moan or cough of a patient. Kate stepped outside a few minutes later, removing her surgical gloves and tossing them into a bin. Then she pulled her surgical mask down and let out a long sigh before she saw Beckham.
"Kate," he said,
Reed.
She hurried over and threw her arms around him.
Did you catch them?
No, and the raider from the island is dead. Kate pulled away with a confused look.
What? How?
He had variant acid. Must have backfired when he tried to use it to escape.
What was he doing with that?
Good question,
Horn said. He blew the smoke skyward. Do we have a death count yet? Beckham asked, looking at the tent.
No, but it just went up by one, Kate replied without turning.
We just lost Macomb.
Macomb, Horn said. As in Senator Macomb?
He was speaking at City Hall when it was hit by the bomb, Kate said. Beckham swallowed with realization. He knew it could just be a coincidence that the senator was here during the attack, but it was hard to believe when looking at the bigger picture. This definitely wasn't a random raider attack. These guys weren't just here to steal shit and sow a little chaos. They had known about the location of the bunker on the island, which meant they had an inside source, and they had known Macomb was going to be here. They also had a clear connection to variants with the acid, which led him to believe they were collaborators.
Maybe that prisoner told us more than we thought, he said.
The acid? Kate asked. Beckham nodded. He grabbed her and pulled her tight, looking at the rising sun. Earlier, he could have bought the raiders weren't working with the monsters, and that they were escaping into the variant zone just to hide. But not now. In this world, Beckham had learned coincidences were never just coincidences. Whoever these guys were, they were connected to the monsters, and he had a feeling the only way to unravel this mystery was to return to hell, where the demons dwelled. 10. The road sign pocked with bullet holes made S.M. Fisher smile every time he drove past.
Is this heaven?
No, it's Texas.
Whoever had hung it years ago had scratched out the word Iowa and replaced it with the Lone Star State. Nothing against the Midwest or Iowa, but there wasn't anything like the Texas panhandle. Fisher would have happily shaken the hand of the fellow that had mounted the sign. He drove his truck solo this morning, but his men weren't far from sight. Three pickups led the way toward the site of one of his damaged oil derricks. It was one of those mornings that he needed time to think and contemplate. He had started it early, getting up before dawn to map out his day. He turned his black dual-cab Ford F-350 down a rust-colored dirt road and eased off the gas to give the truck ahead some room. The golden glow of the morning sun continued to rise in a cloudless ocean of blue. He took in the sights cautiously, recalling why he had stayed here after losing his wife. When he was a child, his parents had sent him to a good Christian boarding school back east. They had a second home in upstate New York, where he had eventually met his wife. During the summers, he had returned to the ranch, where he spent dawn to dusk outside riding horses, driving dirt bikes, and hunting for wild hogs with his father's .357. That same handgun was still nestled in his hip holster. Those were some damn good memories. Now he felt like most of his time on the ranch was spent hunting for variants. Rolling brown hills rose to the west, but the land to the east was flat and green. Portions of old fences lay on their sides beside the dusty road. He didn't bother having them fixed. There was no point in keeping cattle out here anymore. The variants would kill them all, and he didn't have the men to watch the herds. The 3,000 heads he did own were in barns not far from his house. The only way the monsters could get to them were through electric fences and his guards. They had tried in the past, and they had failed every time. But after the attack on several of his derricks the other night, he was starting to wonder how long they could hold them back. The Alpha had been a smart son of a devil. Who knew how many more were out there like it that would encroach on his land in search of food? The convoy of pickup trucks pulled off the dirt road, parking along the shoulder. Fisher maneuvered behind them and then killed the engine. He jumped out, and his most trusted guards, Tran and Chase, got out of the truck ahead. They both wore black fatigues and black baseball caps with the red double F logo. Tran carried an SR-25, and Chase had an M4A1. They nodded at Fisher and flanked him on the walk to the fence. The derrick was on the other side of a hill. The dozen men started out on the path, their rifles up and ready, just in case any variants had returned to finish what they started. At the crest of the hill, Fisher saw that there had been no need to return. He had grown up earning his keep by working on the derricks during the summers when he was back from college, long after his days playing were over. His father had in turn paid for his education. He knew enough about the technology to know when his engineers were right or when they were just being lazy. This time they were right. The derrick was done for.
Son of a bitch, he said, spitting into the dirt.
The skeletal oil derrick was completely blackened and bent at the top. That brought his count from 95 derricks down to 93. It wouldn't hurt production dramatically, but he couldn't afford to keep losing more. Employing so many men and investing in tools and weapons to fend off the variants rang in at a heavy price. At least they had capped the wells before too much oil was burned off.
Did we recover any bodies? Fisher asked Tran.
Tran shook his head.
I doubt we will, Chase said. My guess is they're just bones now.
He glanced at his watch and then took one last look at the derrick before turning away. He needed to scope out the other one and then get back to the ranch to prepare for his meeting with General Cornelius at noon.
Tran, ride with me, Fisher said.
Before his meeting, he wanted to talk to Tran again about his thoughts on the general. The four pickup convoy headed back on the road to the second damaged rig. This one was in plain sight from the road. After putting the truck in park, Fisher used a pair of binoculars to survey the damage.
We got this one capped faster, Tran said from the passenger seat. You think we can get it back up and running?
Maybe, Fisher replied. I'm just not sure if we can recoup the cost, especially since the engineers say they've got about a 50-50 shot at getting that thing functional. Might be better to just strip it of parts and...
His words trailed off when he saw movement.
Sir, Tran said.
You see that?
Fisher whispered, a chill running through him. He zoomed in on movement on the right side of the derrick. Something was hunched over. Tran rolled down the window and brought the scope of his SR-25 up to an eye.
Oh, shit, he muttered. It's a variant.
Fisher opened the door and exited the vehicle.
Sir, Tran said, meeting him at the front of the truck. You should stay inside.
The other men all got out, shouldering their rifles and aiming at the beast in the distance. Fisher calmly reached out to Tran.
Relax, and give me your rifle, he said.
Tran reluctantly handed it over, and Fisher pulled the bipod down. He positioned it on the hood of the truck and lined up the sights on a gruesome scene that made him cringe. Two human corpses lay in the dirt, but it wasn't the dead engineers the variant had all but consumed that repulsed him. It was the charred right side of the creature. Blistering black flesh peeled back to reveal bulbous red tissue the color of a ripe watermelon. The burns extended to the head, covering most of the skull and patchy, melted flesh that had once been its ears.
No wonder it can't hear us, he thought.
It's not going to miss this, though,
Fisher said aloud. He steadied the sights, aiming for the head, moved his finger to the trigger, and pulled. The round found a home in the creature's skull, blowing out a spray of burned flesh. The monster collapsed over the body of the dead engineer. Fisher pulled the rifle off the hood and handed it back to Tran.
Put the bodies of the man in the back of my truck, Fisher ordered.
He got back in his F-350 and waited as his men worked, forcing himself to watch them carry the remains back with them. Chase was right. There wasn't much left but bones. A few minutes later, they set off for the ranch. Fisher still wanted to have that talk with Tran about General Cornelius, but a new sight caused him to delay those plans again.
Is that a chopper? Tran asked.
Fisher looked at the dashboard clock. It was only 10 in the morning. He wasn't late for his meeting. Cornelius, or whoever this was early. Fisher sped around the other trucks and pushed the pedal down, increasing the speed to 80 miles an hour. The vehicle and its oversized wheels easily handled the rough terrain. They hit smooth gray concrete over the next hill, and he gunned the engine to 100 miles an hour. The mile-long stretch of road had cost him a pretty penny, but he liked to greet his guests with smooth roads to remind them where they were when they arrived and what they were leaving when they departed. The Fisher Ranch was a castle in the middle of what had once been the Wild West. The property, with its many barns and multiple buildings, was more than fitting for his oil empire, and it was equally fitting for a meeting with the man many thought would be the next president of the country. Soon, Fisher would make his own determination. The chopper landed in the field on the other side of the circular drive. Fisher parked and watched the men getting out of the bird. Keeping low, they hurried under the blades, all but two of them wearing fatigues. He spotted Cornelius among them. The tallest, with a mane of white hair, the general was the type of guy that stood out in a room, commanding attention. He wore a crisp uniform that seemed immaculately clean for the current state of the world. Dressed in jeans, cowboy boots, and a cowboy hat, Fisher was hardly ready for a meeting with the potential leader of the country. But he honestly didn't care all that much. He wasn't the one asking for money today. Fisher got out of his truck and considered telling his men to drive it with the bodies away. But it was too late.
Mr. Fisher, Cornelius called out.
Fisher walked out to meet the man, smiling, but not too widely. He was a businessman and didn't want to look overeager. Entering negotiations with a poker face was one of the first things his dad taught him.
You're early, General, Fisher said.
He reached out and shook the man's calloused hands.
My apologies, but a lot happened last night, and I wanted to meet with you before I head out east, Cornelius replied.
Fisher motioned for Cornelius to follow him toward the house.
Perhaps if you get elected, you could move the government down here, Fisher suggested. Then you wouldn't have to leave the best state in the Allied States, and you would have prime access to the most productive oil fields to fuel your small army. Don't tell me you aren't interested in them.
Cornelius let out a laugh.
Perhaps, but I've got a lot of other things on my agenda first. Although, you're right. My plans include cooperation with Fisher Fields.
A waft of rotting flesh drifted through the air. Cornelius put a sleeve over his mouth and nose as he passed the truck with the corpses.
Sorry about that, Fisher said. We were surveying the damage to my derricks and found some of my men that had been out there a while.
Cornelius lowered his hand. He didn't seem disturbed by the gory sight.
I'm sorry for your loss, Mr. Fisher, said the general. You weren't the only one that got hit. Something is happening at the outposts and safe zones. Things that I'm sure President Ringgold wants to keep quiet.
Fisher remained standing by the pickup. His curiosity piqued.
Ringgold is a smart woman, Cornelius continued. I like her and Vice President Lemke. They're good people. But they've proven they don't have the strength to protect the country.
Cornelius looked back at the corpses in the truck.
Letting the variants take over the abandoned cities is a strategic failure. Those cities are ticking time bombs waiting to explode. It's negligence like that is leading to the increase in attacks, like the ones on your ranch.
There was anger in the general's voice. Fisher had heard about the general's temper. Anger wasn't necessarily bad if it was controlled. But if the general was the type that let emotion get in the way of a sound decision, that was a problem. Someone leading the country needed to be cool and level-headed, especially when facing threats like this.
That's why I'm here, to make you an offer in return for your support, Cornelius said,
the edge no longer in his voice. Fisher didn't speak too loudly. He didn't want his men to hear the offer just in case Fisher didn't end up accepting it, although he had a feeling whatever it was. It would beat what little Ringgold had done to protect his oil fields. The morning after the attack, Kate had gone straight to the lab to test the samples rushed in by helicopter from Outpost Turkey River. Horn and Beckham were outside with several rangers, and the kids were back at the shelter for survivors in downtown Portland. Knowing Beckham was close and her family was safe helped her focus on the questions. There were hundreds of thoughts on her mind about the attacks, but she tried to keep them all about science. Her job wasn't to figure out who the raiders were or how the attack on Portland and Peaks Island was connected to the other attacks. Her job was to find out what was going on in those variant tunnels. A musty odor hung in the lab, contrasting sharply with the sterile hospital smell that usually pervaded the space. Half of her working area was strewn with individually wrapped pipette tips, syringes, and broken beakers. Muddy boot prints tracked across what had once been a clean, white-tiled floor. Kate brushed aside the cardboard boxes of disposable syringes where they lay scattered on a lab bench. Normally, she would have been bothered by a single pipette negligently left on a lab bench instead of in its stand, or a stray disposable nitrile glove left hanging outside a trash can. but today she had no choice but to work in the filth, hoping that the raiders hadn't taken everything she would need for her experiment. Perusing drawers and cabinets with doors askew, she searched for cell culture supplies. She pulled out a plastic sleeve of cell culture dishes. She could have sworn she had more in stock. In the freezer, all her 1-liter bottles of red liquid cell media were gone, as were the bottles of bovine serum to supplement that media. What in God's name did raiders need cell culture supplies for? Maybe they'd mistaken them for medicine of some kind. Thankfully, she still had a few half-used bottles of media with serum already added in her 4-degree Celsius refrigerator. Cell culture dishes and handheld electronic pipettes at least had not been stolen. Most of the antibiotics she kept on hand for adding to cell cultures were gone, of course. No surprise there. That was okay. As long as she was extremely careful, she could minimize the risk of contaminating her culture dishes. Sitting on the bench in front of her was a cooler-sized styrofoam container with the samples that had been sent to her from Fitz. She lifted one of the 10-milliliter plastic tubes from the container. The red matter in there, whatever it was, had apparently been living just fine in dirt tunnels bored through the ground by the variants outside of Outpost Turkey River. If this stuff had been living in those tunnels, what harm was a little bacteria from the lab anyway? Looking across the lab space to the smaller room where the biosafety cabinets were, the place looked empty. Not for a lack of debris and lab supplies, but Kate found herself thinking of Dr. Pat Ellis, her old laboratory partner. He'd been with her for several years before he met his tragic end. There was still a hole in her heart for the man who'd been both a close and valued co-worker and friend. Now she had to do this alone. She missed Ellis, but especially today. All the death and destruction had peeled back the scabs of time, reopening old emotional wounds. She took the plastic culture dishes and pipettes to one of the biosafety cabinets, inserted them under the protective glass sash. A bottle of pink, pre-warmed liquid cell medium went in next. "Let's see what Team Ghost found," she whispered to herself. Holding the plastic sample tube in one gloved hand, she unscrewed the cap with the other, placing it on the metal surface inside the biosafety cabinet. Images of the scenes inside the medical tent flashed through her mind. Still fresh, she could practically feel Senator McComb's pulse stopping under her fingers again, smell the coppery scent of blood, and hear the cries of the wounded and the frightened. She blinked away the memories and exhaustion, willing herself to wake up. The dregs of adrenaline that helped her through the night faded. She needed every bit of brain power left in her reserves, and it had been so long since she really sat in a lab like this to work on variant-related research. But history had a vicious way of repeating itself. She used a pair of stainless steel forceps to pull a thin strip of the red webbing from the plastic tube. Dangling in the air above the cell culture dish, it could have been a thinly sliced chunk of steak for all she knew. Her fingers trembled as she held the forceps, examining the sample. "You got this, Kate." But in her mind's eye, she saw Timothy standing over his dad again. That look on his face. The pain no child should have to endure. Losing both parents like this. Growing up alone. The trembling in her fingers traced down the length of the forceps, and the red webbing nearly slipped out. Holding her breath, she gently deposited the tendril into the cell culture dish. Next, she filled the dish with cell media from one of the bottles in the refrigerator that hadn't been stolen. Hopefully, it would get the tendril to grow, using a pipette. She continued the process. It was work that any decent lab tech, or even a novice student in biology, could do. Yet now it felt like the hardest thing she had done in her life. But Kate worked through the pain and anguish like she always did, and managed to set up all the samples. She would let them grow and observe their phenotypical changes and behavior. Once she placed the cell culture dishes back in the incubator, she prepared a microscope slide with another razor-thin piece of the webbing. Kate found it hard to believe that this living material had covered those tunnels like Team Ghost had described. When she'd first heard of it, she had figured it must be some kind of fungus. That would explain how it could evidently grow so fast, especially in an underground environment like that. Now she wasn't so sure. She took the prepared slide over to an inverted light microscope. Peering through the scope's eyepiece showed her doubts had weight. Most of the tissue seemed to be made of long, striated cells, clearly mammalian. Between them grew other spidery cells that connected to each other through tendril-like growths that looked suspiciously like dendrites. If she didn't know any better, she would say those spidery cells looked like nerves. And all the others around them might be myoblasts or fibroblasts, muscle cells or connective tissue cells. Cells like that didn't grow outside of an animal or human, though. At least not that she knew of. With the variants, it seemed all the rules of nature had been broken or bent. The trick was figuring out how the cells grew like that, and if these cells had some kind of secrets that would help them find Dohai or prevent another Turkey River event, then she was determined to uncover them. She made a note to check her supplies for the antibody kits she would need to perform proper tissue characterization assays on these cells. It might be a few days before she got the proper supplies if she was missing anything. Team Ghost would need her results to have some idea of what they were dealing with in the tunnels. Dohai likely didn't have time to wait for robust experiments, assuming he was still alive. Whatever clues might be in these samples needed to be found now. There was no time to do every experiment and replicate and put each hypothesis through a battery of tests. She would have to go with her gut on this one, move forward with her hypothesis, and verify later. So for now, she would operate as if these cells were indeed a mixture of nerve and muscle cells. But if they were, the question was why. And nearly as important, what kind of creature grew these types of cells? The dark round spots of nuclei inside them were readily apparent, and there was no thick, square-like cell well wall holding them together. Definitely not plant or fungus derived like she had originally thought. As she studied the cells, she noticed something peculiar. Some of the nuclei were actually dividing in front of her eyes, and as they did, so too did the cytoplasm, all the gooey parts inside the cells. That couldn't be possible. She blinked, half tempted to pinch herself to make sure she wasn't dreaming, taken by exhaustion. Sure enough, when she stared back through the eyepiece, she saw that the cells were in fact dividing. They weren't just dividing. They were growing. Odd, considering the slice she'd prepared for the slide wasn't in perfect physiological conditions like the cell culture dishes in the incubator. Mammalian cells just didn't do a good job growing unless they were in the right temperature, humidity, oxygen levels, and nutrients. Yet here these were, not only dividing, but spreading across the slide rapidly. "This can't be," she whispered. Ellis would have loved seeing this. She stored the slide in a culture dish and kept it on the table next to the scope, too afraid to simply discard it. Before she threw it out, she made a mental note to douse this thing in acid or burn it, just to make sure it didn't start growing from a landfill or something. Then she went back to the incubator, pulled out one of the cell culture dishes, and placed it on the microscope's stage. She didn't even have to look through the eyepiece to see that the cells within that dish had already adapted to their environment. The tissue sample pulsed wildly, contracting and expanding randomly throughout the strand. When viewed through the scope, the images there only confirmed her suspicions. Those cells she thought were myoblasts were moving. Just like cardiomyocytes, the cells that automatically contracted and released to maintain a person's heartbeat. What frightened her even more was seeing that as the cells pulsed, they continued to divide. It looked like she was watching a tumor grow in time-lapse images. Only instead of taking weeks or months for the tumor to become malignant and spread, it was happening in seconds. Kate's stomach sank as she peeled herself away from the scope. The variants had tested her knowledge and understanding of biology from the very start. Now it was as if they were toying with her and torturing her with the unknown. But she would not be tricked. If these biological samples contained the clues that would stop whatever happened at Outpost Turkey River from spreading, she would crack the code. 11. Everything hurt. That was the first thing that made its way into Dohai's dulled consciousness. Sharp pain radiated through his elbows and throbbed along his spine. His mind seemed to be trapped in a dark pool. Maybe his body, too. He couldn't see anything but black. Fear joined the pain, and adrenaline churned through his vessels. The grogginess fogging his mind faded, and he felt his limbs again. Something was dragging him over the ground. The rush of blood helped activate his senses, and the memories flooded him with the events at Outpost Turkey River. Variants had ambushed him, and he had fallen into a tunnel. Everything after that was a haze. There was no easy way to tell how long he'd been out or how far he had been dragged. His headset and night vision goggles were busted to shit. His rifle had been lost in the fray. Slowly, he felt near his hip. At least his M1911 was still in its holster. Thankfully, so was the tactical light on his utility belt. If he stood any chance of escaping, he would need both. That was going to be very difficult, judging from the huge claws wrapped around one of his ankles. While he couldn't see the beast, he could tell right away this was no ordinary grunt variant. At least not judging by the heavy thwack of its footsteps and the bellowing, huffing breaths it let out. Suddenly, the creature let out a high-pitched squeal and a series of clicks. A variant answered in the distance. The abomination dragged him deeper into the tunnel. The squawks and clicking of joints echoed. Without the luxury of sight, Dohai concentrated on his other senses. The rotten fruit odor of the creatures overwhelmed him, especially the stink of the monster dragging him along. If he let his fingers relax, tracing along the tunnel floor, he could feel the moist earth, and more prominently, the stretchy webbing that he'd seen before he'd fallen into the tunnel. Every time he made contact with the organic material, it made the hair on his arm stand straight. The air itself left a biting, cruel taste on his tongue, making his stomach roil, almost as if he had taken a long swig of chunky, spoiled milk. He tried to focus on counting the number of variants, but the agonized cries of the other human captives made the task difficult. He guessed there were at least half a dozen grunts marching in front of the monstrous knuckle-dragger pulling him along. Maybe he was thinking about this the wrong way. Maybe this was a break, and the bastards would take him right to their nest. If he could escape, he would have the location of his lair and the rest of the people from Outpost Turkey River. But escaping was going to be next to impossible down here. He went back to using his internal compass to try and track the path just in case he might have an opportunity. The path seemed to wind and curve so much, it was difficult to maintain any semblance of proper orientation. The longer he was dragged, the worse of a beating he took. His mind struggled to maintain focus, and he couldn't tell if he'd gone unconscious again, or if time passed differently in the inky darkness. In truth, he had no idea how long he had been down here. A piercing scream suddenly echoed down the tunnel, followed by the unmistakable splatter of blood. The clamor of squawking variants exploded through the murk. Something primal roared in Dohai. Pure instinct, ingrained by years of evolution, prepping him for a flight or fight response. Another human scream blared, cut short by a tearing sound. Then a thump, like a body falling, followed by another, lighter thump. Dohai imagined a headless body hitting the ground and a horde of variants consuming the meat. A moment later, the monstrous creature pulling him halted. Dohai tried to control his breathing. The beast gave him a single tug, inching him forward slightly. Another human shrieked. That's when he made his move. With all his strength, he yanked his boot free from his captor. The monster was caught off guard and jerked backward as Dohai pulled his M1911 from its holster and with his other hand pulled out his tac light. He flicked the flashlight on and spun on his captor, bringing the handgun to bear in concert with the light's beam. Time seemed to slow. The tunnel around him was nearly twice as tall as Dohai, and the beast before him took up most of that space. An ape-like face with exaggerated, pointed features rotated in his direction. Huge nostrils flared, and its lips tore back to reveal a set of curved fangs. Large, bat-like ears fanned off the side of its face, and its wide, webbed claws were caked in dirt. Dohai had expected the creature to stare him down, or maybe, if he was lucky, throw a clawed hand in front of its eyes to shield itself from the sudden blinding light. But this alpha didn't even move away from the beam. It was then he realized its milky white eyes weren't even looking at him. Suddenly, the high-pitched squeals and clicks made sense. The beast was using echolocation, perfectly suited for the tunnel. Dohai didn't waste another second and pulled the trigger.
Click.
Shit, he muttered.
The beast simply tilted its head, not realizing how lucky it was that his gun hadn't fired. Muscles rippled down the length of its body, and some kind of viscous goo coated its smooth flesh. Claws large enough to go straight through Dohai's chest and out the other side protruded from its fingers. Thin tendrils sprouted from its spine. Each of those fibers seemed to prod at the webbing along the tunnel wall. The beast released another high-pitched shriek. Now he was fucked. Dohai quickly pulled the slide back to chamber around and pulled the trigger as the beast homed in on him, two rounds buried in its barreled chest. He kept the beam aimed on the creature as he fired. Blood and bits of clear goo flecked off in the light. The other variant in the tunnel dropped their human captives ahead. In the glow of his beam, he noticed humans stuck in the red webbing. The strange growths seemed to spread out of their open mouths and eyes. Dohai had no time to make sense of the horrific scene. The variants charged around the Alpha. One of the monsters flung itself into the air, claws outstretched. Dohai fired twice into the creature's center mass, sending it sliding across the tunnel floor. Two more trampled over their dead comrade, and Dohai took them out in quick succession and then put a round in the Alpha's skull, sending it hunching against the wall. He quickly pushed himself up and limped away, changing his magazine while he moved. Every step hurt, each tremor rocking through his bruised bones. Palming in the mag, he turned and raised the gun and light at the pursuing variants. He squared off another shot that slammed into the head of the lead monster. Two more darted past, and he took them both down with shots to their T-sections. The giant Alpha roared behind them and then lumbered forward on all fours, using its wide claws to help propel itself forward like a gorilla. Dohai sent another shot straight through the chest of the last grunt variant. The beast crumpled, tumbling headfirst into the webbing. The Alpha careened forward, stomping the dead into the mud while letting out another piercing shriek. The long fibrous growths tracing along the red webbing tensed. Dohai could almost feel the air explode with electricity. He pulled the trigger again, sending a bullet punching into the Alpha's chest that resulted in a raucous roar. It seemed to absorb the impact. Another trigger squeeze, and the slide locked. The pistol was empty, and he was out of magazines. He had lost his buck knife in the fall with his rifle. All he had to defend himself with were his hands. Those fight-or-flight instincts kicked in again. This time he chose the latter of the two. Dohai ran, using his light to guide him through the tunnel. Webbing snagged at his boots and shoulders, and he broke through the sticky vine-like growths. The earthen corridors branched. He took random turns, no idea where he was headed. Grunts and squeals resounded through the tunnel as the beast used echolocation to track him. But even when Dohai was far out of what he judged as the beast's effective sonar range, the monster still pursued. That left only a few other possibilities, scent being one of them. But he couldn't help but wonder if the webbing also had something to do with it being able to track him. He pictured those fibrous growths sprouting from the Alpha's spine and tracing the webbing. Running wasn't going to help him escape either of those things. He stopped around another bend and placed his hand between the gaps in the webbing. Easily, his fingers pressed through the muddy soil. Maybe. He turned around and stretched the webbing over himself. Then he slowly squirmed backward into the mud. With his hands, he smeared it over his body in cold, wet globs. As best he could, he dug out a shallow cavity in the wall. The stomping of the Alpha grew closer, squeals erupting down the tunnel. Mud slopped around Dohai's shoulders, and he squeezed it over his helmet, into his hair, and over his cheeks. Another high-pitched shriek echoed down tunnel. He flicked off his flashlight and stuffed it into his pocket. He was almost certain the Alpha couldn't see, but he didn't want to take any chances. The ground trembled. The beast wasn't far. Dohai sucked in a deep breath and closed his eyes. The tunnels were already steeped in darkness, but he couldn't help the natural instinct to make every bit of him disappear in that mud under the web. The clicking grew louder. The beast couldn't have been more than a yard or more away now. Massive feet slopped along the muck, and a rolling growl sounded. Dohai could smell rancid breath, but he kept his mouth clamped shut, the air still in his lungs. A sniffing followed the growl.
It knows I'm here. It knows.
Another whoosh of rank breath pushed past Dohai's mud-covered face.
The creature was right in front of him. Was it toying with him? His lungs burned, but he held the same breath inside. If he let it out, the beast would tear out his guts. As the seconds passed, his heart thumped harder. Could it hear that? The creature growled again. Then it stomped away, taking off down the passage the way they had come. Dohai waited a few more moments before slowly letting out a breath. He gulped down a mouthful of the tunnel air. Musty and rotten as it was, air had never tasted sweeter. He stayed in the mud behind the webbing until those clicks and squeals finally went silent. After another 15 minutes had passed, he emerged from the mud and squeezed back through the gaps in the webbing. He pulled his fingers over his face and threw his goatee, flaking the mud away. With nothing but a flashlight to find his way out of here, he set off, knowing what he had seen had to be relayed to command before another outpost was attacked. The very future of the country could rest on his escape. The late afternoon sunlight filtered through the trees the day after Team Ghost lost Dohai. They remained at Outpost Turkey River, where they had received a resupply in the evac that had taken Cedric Long to command for questioning, and the samples Fitz collected for Kate. Fitz wasn't leaving until they had recovered Dohai. Every passing hour, he knew the chances of finding him alive were shrinking. But Dohai was the best tracker on Team Ghost, a veritable bloodhound. If anyone could survive underground in the variant-infested superhighway, it was Dohai. Fitz checked his team as they continued the search for their lost brother. Mendez was on point. Lincoln had rear guard, his gaze roving the skeletal trees. Fitz and Rico were between them. Ace wore a large black backpack that held a rugged computer system and battery connected to the long gray tubular instrument he carried. The tube looked like an old-fashioned bazooka, except that it had an LCD screen glowing up toward Ace. He held it over the ground in front of him like a minesweeper. When command had learned of the team's situation, they had offered the perfect solution. Along with fresh ammunition, a group of army engineers had dropped off an R2TD, or Rapid Reaction Tunnel Detection System, developed over a decade ago by the U.S. Army. It used ground-penetrating radar to detect tunnels, as well as the sounds and activity of people or machinery underground. Before abandoning some of the cities to variants after the Great War ended, the device was widely used by squads just like Team Ghost. While operating the device was easy enough, discerning the signal from noise on the detection screen Ace was staring at was more of an art than a science, and would require communication with two Army combat engineers.
Overwatch 1, Ghost 1, Fitz whispered. Anything?
Negative, Ghost 1.
Lieutenant Scott, the engineer assisting them, replied.
We'll ping you if we see something. Over.
For all the magic that the engineers had promised them this R2TD system could accomplish, they had found precious little to show for it. Fitz looked over at Rico with a raised brow. An unspoken question.
Can you believe this?
She shrugged back. For far too many hours, they'd been scouring the forest with only the rustle of the trees to keep them company. They hadn't found a single tunnel, nothing to take them to Dohai or the escaped variants. He was halfway tempted to try something drastic, start setting up explosives.